Okay, this is continuing with Bart Bach on 7 December 1978 with a bit more of the interview that was started on 5 December 78, and actually another part of the interview was back in 1971.
Now, you were saying that the main function that you saw of the observatory at that time
was basically this, was to explore several different aspects of 21 centimeter research, rather than to plan a long-range major program like the Dutch spiral structure or so. We were also aware of the fact that, say, in Sydney, Joe Pawsey and Daffy Bowen and John Bolt and the rest had, first of all, people who were very much better trained in the background of the field than we could have.
Right.
But I felt very strongly that there was a need to have astronomically trained and astronomy appreciating young people come out and help in as staff members in the radio astronomy. Because the radio astronomy that there was at that time in the United States, John Krause, for example, and others, was all oriented away from astronomy and more towards electronics. And I think we succeeded in that, in doing it, that we got people like, well, Dave Heeshan, Frank Drake, Coach Hugh Mannon, Campbell Wade, Ed Lilly, Nan Dieter, well, there were 12 of them all together that worked in there. And for example, you can now see it in Campbell Wade. Campbell Wade thinks on fundamental positions. The reason why he's so effective in that, that he knows damn well how to handle precession, galactic rotation, and all the fundamental things of astronomy.
Right.
So I think we succeeded in that way. The other part was, if you ask where were the contributions made, I think first of all, the fact that the Gould's belt came out in atomic hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The second thing is that we showed, Bob Lawrence helped out with that, and Coach U2 with me, that we showed that the darker spots had no excess concentrations of atomic hydrogen. And then, as we said already at the Paris Symposium, Tom Gold and I were the ones who argued that that must mean there is a lot of molecular hydrogen in those parts. It's just too cool to keep the atomic stuff going. Then there was co-choosing on the Orion nebula, which I always felt was in some ways one of our biggest contributions, and Dave Heeshan's first indication that the curves near the galactic center had dips in them and self-absorption. So there were quite a few things that came out of it, but I would always claim that the biggest thing was that we were a training ground for people who had contact with it. I must admit to one sin, that we believed in purchasing black boxes. And the purchasing of black boxes is not the ultimate solution, but that we felt we had to get quickly into the business. And with Doc Ewan appreciating the astronomer and being quite competent in the black box business, we went in with him. And it was sort of a little bit of a fly-by-night affair. But we did get the good people out.
Right.
And we were all very, very prominent in the setting up of Greenback. And that was going on.
And of course, you didn't have the funds to set up a whole receiver laboratory.
If I had done that, the whole thing would have gone to pieces and we would have never got off the ground.
You already said
we were lucky enough that we could get $200,000 for the 60-footer after Mrs. Agassiz gave us the $25,000 for the 24-footer.
Well, along this same line, you obviously felt that the U.S. had a need for these sort of training.
I had a very strong feeling that the future of Milky Way astronomy was going to be, say, half radio, half optical. None of my colleagues agreed with that. They all said, well, I told you the counter story, flesh in the pan sort of thing. And I felt very strongly that from now on we had to play the piano at all ends.
Right.
And therefore we had to begin to train astronomers who would be able to move back and forth even though they were not properly electronically trained for one part.
Right. Yeah. I'd like to pursue, though, in the U.S. versus other countries, what do you see as the basic reasons why the U.S. lagged behind in the development of radio astronomy?
That nobody took an interest in. very few people.
But why did they not go? I mean,
because they hadn't looked carefully enough what the potential was. Jesse Greenstein, in a way, he was early in the game, one of the very best ones. But for the rest, in the 30s, early 40s, and even after the war, everybody was busy with other things.
Do you think it might be that they had a couple large optical telescopes, whereas other countries didn't, and therefore they had more to keep them busy?
And they had lots to keep them busy, and they all felt, I felt until I got into it, that the things I was doing optically were basic, and the rest was the side issues. But then when I came back from South Africa in 51, 52, talked with Purcell and Ewan especially, then suddenly the whole thing began to blossom out. Another person who had a lot of effect on me was John Hagen.
Mm-hmm.
So John Hagen was, in a way, lots of people didn't like him, but he was a very good friend of mine, and he was a great helper of seeing the directions in which things were going. More so than, for example, John Krauss. John Krauss was a competent electronic engineer who didn't mind setting up big projects and well, but anything else. Covington was basically a solar radio physicist who did his things on the sun, and there wasn't much vision elsewhere. Then, of course, the other thing that came in, that Hort and van der Hulst and I had long been close friends, and that made it very easy for me to hear from the other side. And then I was very fortunate that Joe Pawsey came to Harvard early in the 50s, 52, 53, and he and I became very close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of these things, it was natural, but I was one of the few who saw that I got to know the radio astronomers. We went, mostly at our own expense, to the General Bank Symposium on Radio Astronomy, which was one of the early ones, where only Minkowski was practically the only other astronomer who was...
Are you talking about the 53 or the 55 one?
The 53, the early one.
Right.
Or 52, 53. 53
it was.
53 yeah. was. No, the 50, that one, yes. Not the 55, by that time, things had become already respectable.
Right. Well, just from the two group photos, you can see the difference in the number of people that attended.
Oh yes, the whole thing. We have the 55.
That photo is split in two.
Yeah.
About twice as many people.
Yes.
But I realize it's difficult to disentangle your own character, but I mean, what was it that allowed you to see that this field was going places? What was it about the way you looked at it that was different?
Well, that I had the feeling. I was very impressed with the Dutch early spiral pictures. That suddenly we were getting through the muck in the Milky Way that I hadn't been able to get through. We'd been pushing and pushing for it. And here suddenly it was a God-given opportunity to go through it. And we had the man who could build the black boxes at the price right in our backyard.
Right.
And therefore it was silly not to become involved in it.
Or maybe were there many other optical astronomers worrying about spiral structure in the early 50s?
Yes. It was Morgan. But Morgan never looked at radio astronomy at all. And Bill Morgan never looked at the Southern Hemisphere. Even now the Carinan feature hardly figures in Bill Morgan's thinking. And definitely, but he did, of course, the basic breakthrough with his precision classification of spectral types and luminosities and got the first real spiral arms drawn.
Okay, along that same line, is it simply a coincidence that it was the same year, 1951, in which the hydrogen line was discovered and the first optical tracing of spiral structure also came out? Is that just a coincidence?
I think it was a coincidence, because in a way the optical tracing of spiral structure started with Walter Bader's survey of the Andromeda Galaxy. And Walter said to Bill Morgan, "Bill, if you want to find out about spiral structure in our galaxy, you ought to learn to classify these stars properly, get their distance, find where they are, and you get the spiral features." In the meantime, the Dutch had a 21 centimeter thing, but that ran entirely separate from each other.
Right. Okay. Along the same...
Independent Day, with one exception, that Ort was, of course, at the height of his power and the height of his glory, and Ort was the one who knew about both these things and was deeply involved in both of them,
to
tie them all together into a unified affair. But the Dutch radio astronomers were not as perceptive as Ort.
About the actual spiral structure that was being found, the Dutch, of course, produced these maps with all these filaments and arms and so forth. What was your attitude at that time towards these maps? Did this seem like this was definitely the way the gas was?
And near circular, slight tilts, and near circular spiral arms.
So there was not much questioning about the validity of the whole kinematic map.
No, particularly by that time, we had no Butler and Burton around to tell us that there were velocity-produced fields that could do it just as well, and little disturbances and edges and so. So, in a way, we were very unsophisticated about it and took the Dutch results when there is a peak, there is a spiral, they will pass through the spiral arm.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if we had had Butler and Burton around in those days, it would have been very bad. I don't think we would have looked at it as much.
But now, as to the actual matter of how you connect up the spiral features, there were some arguments, and I have a little paper you wrote in Observatory in 1959.
Yes, I thought that the Cygnus and Carina arm
broke
together.
And you argued with the establishment view, meaning Kerr and Westerhout in order, about the Carina Cygnus feature, and also about the Orion spur, and they called it an arm.
And some of these things are still going on, and the Orion is really much more of a spur. Looking at it, the principal thing where I think I made my contribution was by convincing everybody that the Carina arm was a major feature and much bigger and more bountiful than the Orion spur, which was sort of a connecting link. And that you have basically you have the Perseus feature, the Carina feature, and the inner Sagittarius feature. And whether the Carina Sagittarius were tied up, I was against this, because there are gaps, variegate gaps in between. And the gap between the Carina and Sagittarius feature is almost as big as the gap between the Cygnus and Carina feature.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I drew this little diagram and said, maybe the two of them go together the other way. And it was a good thing to make it clear that one couldn't know how all this went.
Yeah. What do you think, if you look at all of the work that was done on galactic structure up until 1960 or 62 or so, what were the important things that gave us a new insight into the nature of the Milky Way that we hadn't had before? I mean, we knew it was a spiral before.
No, we didn't.
We didn't?
I used to say in the 1930s in my public lecture, if 300 years from now I come back and ask one question, the question will be, does the Milky Way have spiral structure? Yes.
I don't know.
No, we thought it would happen, but there was no proof for it whatsoever. But I did one thing back already in the 30s, starting in 32, I used to argue that the Carina feature was the most prominent spiral arm that there was anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But no astronomers up north knew the word Carina or had any idea what this meant. And for that reason, this never flew off the ground and nobody listened to me. That's all right.
Okay, so we knew it was a disk, but we didn't know if there was spiral structure.
We weren't sure, but it seemed most likely there would be.
And of course, the radio observation showed that there was an awful lot of gas, which was of interest.
That was, yes, the radio. That's where the radio came in, And that gas had peaks in the 21-centimeter profiles. And in the early days, we all accepted that the peak meant we were crossing the spiral arm in that direction.
Did the observations change one's ideas of the interstellar medium greatly?
Not especially. I don't think that affected it much, because I don't think my ideas about the interstellar medium changed much after the 1930s. We certainly needed the interstellar absorption, and the Crumpler came in. But we had the interstellar absorption lines, and they did what they ought to do. We had the nebula and so. So I don't think that there was a very basic change, except that the atomic hydrogen came in strongest at 21 centimeters.
Right. But the parameters of the interstellar media didn't change that much from what one expected.
We had arguments whether they were in clouds or uniformly distributed and so on. Right. And these arguments we can still have.
It's still going on,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, really, the revolution in the interstellar medium, I think there has been one, but that's been more the last 10 years than in the 50s.
Yes, yes, yes. Particularly the recognition now, of course, that's why I've come back to star formation, how star formation dies right. all in this.
Which wasn't being worried about much at all in the 50s. I mean, there was a... Martin Schmidt,
no.
of course, wrote his little paper, but
yes.
There wasn't much concern about that. Okay. In your book with Priscilla in 57 of the edition, you have a chapter on radio astronomy, but I was very interested that there was no mention in that chapter of synchrotron radiation.
It was all still too early, and I must say I was much more impressed personally with the 21 centimeter stuff. I felt very strongly that ought to come out. The synchrotron was difficult to do. Bernie Mills was getting the first synchrotron edges, but they were
in terms of spiral structure. But of course, we had radio sources. We had the galactic background.
Yes.
And it was a problem to understand what was the source of the emission. It couldn't be too hot a gas. I mean, that seemed unreasonable.
Yes. I just didn't know quite what to do about it.
Okay.
And neither did Priscilla. And what we did is we brought the things in. Our book is, after all, not one on radio astronomy, it was a book on the Milky Way.
Right.
What does radio astronomy, where has it contributed the most? And those contributions came mostly from the 2170 in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio sources, of course, the great majority, well, there were two types. There were the H2 region sources, and I thought we mentioned those.
Oh, you did, and the supernova remnants.
Yes, we did those.
Crab
but
so
we
so
did the rest of them. Were colliding galaxies, you know, mm-hmm. like the Cygnus source and all these interpretations.
Yeah, and you did mention the general galactic background, mm-hmm. but there was no mention of what it might be caused by.
No. And principally because I think I didn't know, neither did so.
Although I gather from if you were going to these radio astronomy meetings in 53 and 55 at Jodrell and the 58 Paris Symposium, you certainly. Heard about the ideas of synchrotrons but you were not accepting them as
well, not really, basically, yet interested, seeing no direct application to our own galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it came down to.
Well, the only thing that I have left is if you can remember any impressions of these meetings. Anecdotes or papers.
Well, the first meeting really I remember the one at the one that we had at John Robeck, the
first one.
In '53.
Right.
I was scared stiff. For I said, I don't know any of these people. I know Wim Hofsky, but for the rest, I don't know anybody. And we sat, Priscilla and I, during the whole meeting, sat two rows from the back. I remember we didn't have the nerve to get up forward and so. Wait, and I got to know, among others, Leonard Huxley sat beside us. There was a quiet
also
person,
sitting in the back.
And also in the back, so we got acquainted with the future vice chancellor of our university.
Uh-huh.
But Len Huxley and the box became close friends, but sitting so scared in the back. And he gave a few brief papers on the beginnings of our radio plans at Agassiz mm-hmm. Station. But I came to that one principally to find out what the heck was going on.
All right, well, that's why it would be valuable for me to hear, if you can try to remember, what was your impression? I mean, who struck you as the dominant figures or what as the important problems?
Well, in those days, of course, that's why I got to learn to know Bernie Mills. Martin Ryle, we saw quite a bit of Ryle, and Ryle showed us his first array that he had at Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
and that was a great moment. You suddenly had the feeling you were in the presence of wholly new things. Bernard Lovell was the scene I was impressed with. So just the people who were there was an impressive book. Christiansen was there. Joe Pawsey was not at that meeting. I don't know why not, but he was not there. And then there were people like Biermann, whom we had known, and right. Hank van der Hulst and Hort and so with whom we naturally communicated rather easily. The Paris one, when I went there, I began to feel like an accepted big shot.
Yeah.
And I just marched in and sat on the second row and had a fine time, you know. And Ed Lilly and Dave Isher were there and the whole gang. And by that time we felt it was an establishing and we were going places as fast as we could. And then in connection with the Paris Symposium after that, and the IAU meeting came about the same time, there was then the dealing, or that was even, that was a joke for Bangham.
Well, there was one connected with the Dublin meeting in 55.
That's right. And the Dublin meeting was where I heard that I'd been nominated by Joe Pawsey for the directorship at Stromlo.
I see.
And by that time, I began to feel like a reasonable big shot and knew what was going on and knew all the people in the field mm-hmm. and things were easier. But the first meeting was a scary affair.
At the Paris Symposium, there was a lot of dissension over radio source counts and so forth, which you probably remember.
Yeah.
In the 21-centimeter field, I get the idea that there was not a great amount of dissension. In fact, everyone was cooperating very much.
Everything was going together, and Butler Burton hadn't been born yet, so we didn't. None of us really had an idea that the radio thing would that it might blow up in our own faces. Fairly soon afterwards.
But why do you think that these fields developed differently? Was it just a matter of the personalities in the fields?
Yes. In 21 centimeter, of course, there was one dominating and domineering personality, Jan Oort. Don't forget that. And Jan Oort ran the whole business like a typical Jan Oort unit affair.
Right.
Whereas in radio astronomy, there were from the beginning three sort of separate big things sticking out in the synchrotron radiation, the galaxy counts. There was Joe Pawsey, this Bernie Mills, that is this big chieftain in the whole thing. There was Martin Ryle on the other side, and then there was Bernard Lovell,
right. The
third one. So there were three strongly competing, disagreeing groups that all worked together.
Mm-hmm. Or did not work together.
That all worked in the same area. Let's put that. Did not work together.
Okay. Well, that's about it. Unless you feel any other areas about pre 1960 radio astronomy.
The only thing that one has is one has to be very careful. For the tendency for radio and optical not to cooperate seems to be there all the time, to both sides.
Even today.
And that goes on and on. That went on later on, for example, at Stromlo, my successor was Ole Wergen, who said immediately, no more contact with these silly groups of radio physics. 66, 67. Mm-hmm. No more contact, we have important astronomy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in some ways, people like Bernie Mills can, on the other side, be just as firm in saying, well, the only thing that you need is astronomy is just the field where you apply your advanced knowledge.
Right.
But it doesn't take any knowledge of astronomy, that's a simple, stupid field.
Yeah.
So it comes from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think, very nice that Joe Pawsey and I were together, who had this dedicated view that it wasn't that way. In Holland, Oort and van der Hulst have helped, of course, to hold the thing together. In Britain, there was a long time when, for example, the Astronomer Royal wouldn't have much to do with radio astronomy
at
the time.
Now we have Graham Smith as head of RGO.
We have Martin Ryle as the Astronomer Royal.
Right. But do you think that there ever was an error, and if so, can you name the date, when radio astronomy became accepted as part of astronomy, or has it always
been a distinct? I think there are two things. Radio astronomy got accepted by astronomy, I would say, around 56, 57. And astronomy got accepted by radio astronomy about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mutual affair. That when I first came in, I felt I was looked upon with considerable suspicion. Not by the physicists like Ed Purcell and Norman Ramsey, that was fine. Or even by the Doc Ewens. But the other ones were suspicious. But Joe Pawsey never had this. And Joe was a very great unifier.
But you're saying after 3 or 4 years, you felt that this had
gone away? When I arrived in Stromlo, I felt there was no problem at all of having close collaboration with the radio stations. And they used to come to us and go to them.
What do you think were the key aspects that allowed this transition to take place? Was it simply that the radio
stations... Getting acquainted with each other. And attending each other's symposia and having International Astronomical Union symposia that both had optical radio and then the forming of Commission 40 was, of course, a very important part in the whole thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay.
That ends the interview with Bart Bach on 7 December 1978 at the University of Washington.